The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
When I was a little boy, my mum bought me Speedos. Now, we all have a love-hate relationship with Speedos because every 10 years, Speedos would come into fashion only to go out of fashion again. And so in the 1960s, when I was born, Speedos were in fashion. And then in the 1970s, when I was in primary school, they were out of fashion. In the 1980s, when I was in high school, they were back in fashion. But in the 1990s, when I was working, they were out of fashion, but no one told me. So I kept wearing my Speedos. So I became that guy in Speedos. See, I wish I knew back then what I know now. Speedos are out. Do not wear them. No one else is wearing them. See, in life, we often look back and say, boy, I wish I knew back then what I know now. When we were dating, my wife and I went to a restaurant, and my wife ate some vegetables, and she got the green bit stuck between her teeth. And I didn't tell her. And afterwards, she was horrified that I hadn't told her she had green bits between her teeth. And I told her, I pleaded ignorance. I didn't know that I was in the role of a boyfriend to do that. But my wife tells me no. And I think she's right, because if you love someone, if they need to know something, you tell them. If people need to know, you tell them. So tonight's topic is 5 lessons to learn before we're 25. And my name is Sam. I'm giving tonight's talk. Not because I'm wiser than you guys, not because I'm smarter, not because I'm better than you guys, just simply because I'm in my late 40s and I have made way more mistakes than everyone in this room. And so I think, boy, I wish I knew back then what I know now, and it would be nice if you guys knew these things. So I'm going to give you 5 lessons to learn before we're 25, 25-minute talk, and afterwards there will be a chance for some Q&A. So lesson number 1, it's okay to be hopeless at what we do. Now, when I began working as a college lecturer, I was very disappointed in myself because my lectures were boring, my students looked like this, and I didn't know how to answer questions. So I went to a senior lecturer and I said, well, what's your secret? Because your lectures are amazing. You can answer any question and the students are interested. And he just said to me, well, I've been teaching for over 20 years. You just started. It's okay. You're okay for where you are. It's okay to be not totally competent at what we do when we first begin work. See, in life, in work, there's what's called the 5-5-5 rule. When we begin work, in the first 5 years of work, we're just learning what we've been trained to do. We won't be competent. We won't be good at what we do. We're just learning what we've been trained to do. But in the next 5 years, that's when we become competent. That's that sweet spot, and we really start enjoying our work because we are good at what we've been trained to do. And in the next 5 years after that, that's where we train people, and we train junior workers, and we train a replacement. So it's the 5-5-5 rule. It takes 5 years to be good at what we do. And you see that in the world of medicine, because when you graduate as a doctor, in the first 5 years, you're called a resident doctor. And then the next 5 years, you become a registrar doctor in a streamlined specialty like orthopedics that you choose. And then the next 5 years, you become a surgeon. And it takes 5 years to set up practice as a surgeon. But basically, it takes 5 years to become good at what you do. A first-year-out surgeon is not going to be as competent as a 5-years-out surgeon. And I used to always be really down on myself. Like when I was a resident, I used to think, why can't I be like the registrar? And when I was a registrar, I was thinking, why can't I be like the surgeon? But basically, it takes 5 years before we become good at what we've been trained to do. Malcolm Gladwell, in his book Outliers, where he looks at outliers, and, you know, this is the bell curve of people, the outliers are out here. They are way good. They are just way out here, all by themselves. He says, well, what makes outliers outliers? And he said, one main factor is they have done what they've been doing for 10,000 hours. That's why they're outliers. And 10,000 hours is basically the equivalent of 5 years of full-time work. It takes 5 years to become good at what we do. Now, Kelly Slater has been a world champion surfer. He's won the world championship 11 times. And if you surf, often you think, well, why can't I surf like Kelly Slater? Well, because he's done 10,000 hours of surfing that we haven't done. And it's all right, because Kelly Slater is probably looking at us and thinking, well, why can't I do an Excel spreadsheet like you guys can? And we say, well, Kelly, we have done 10,000 hours on Excel spreadsheets that you have not done. But basically, it takes 5 years before we become competent at something. So number one tip, it's okay in our first 5 years to be hopeless at what we do. There's a five-year cycle. Number two, we can learn to unleash the power of habit. Unleash the power of habit. My grandfather taught me that it takes just as much effort to form a good habit as it does to form a bad habit. In the same way we can be addicted to drinking or spending, we can be also addicted to exercise and saving. So what forms a habit? Charles Duhigg, in his book, The Power of Habit, says three things will form a habit. Three things. The first thing is a stimulus, which then leads to a behaviour, which then leads to a reward, and that reward creates the loop, it creates the habit cycle. Stimulus, behaviour, reward. And so let's say we have a habit where every Friday night we like to go for Friday drinks. That's our habit. Well, what is the stimulus? The stimulus is, hey, it's Friday. So the behaviour becomes, hey, let's go for drinks, let's have a beer. The reward is, oh, I'm more relaxed, I've unwound. And if you do that often enough, that creates a Friday night drinks habit. But it doesn't have to be drinks. On Friday night, you might like to go shopping. On Friday, you might like to go for a run. On Friday, you might like to put away $500 every week for a holiday or something. Of course, that won't happen. Maybe $5 is more realistic. But you see, it creates habit stimulus, behaviour, and it's the same reward. So how can we form good habits early in life? Well, you have to set up a stimulus, set up the behaviour that you want to make your good habit, and set up a reward. So let's say you want to go running every Saturday to keep fit. Well, set up a stimulus. Get a friend to meet you at the park on Saturday morning. And then when you meet the friend, go for a run. And after the run, have a reward, like a coffee or a Big Mac. And if you do that often enough, you will create a habit. You create a good habit. And it's the same with a bad habit. How do bad habits form? Well, if you want to get rid of a bad habit, recognize what the stimulus is, recognize the bad behavior that you're trying to get rid of, and recognize what the reward might be. So let's say you want to get rid of the habit of Friday night drinks. The beer, too many calories, you're putting on weight, doctor's saying you're getting a fatty liver, you should cut down your drinking. Okay, I pick up a bad habit of Friday night drinks. So recognise the stimulus. The stimulus is Friday night. Recognise the stimulus. And your behaviour is you're going for a beer on Friday night. Again, okay, but you're thinking, okay, I want to cut down on the calories. What is the reward that feeling after a beer, I've unwound, I've relaxed, that's your habit. Well, change the behaviour to maybe green tea. So next time it's Friday, go for a green tea and you get the, believe it or not, the same reward. Or you might say, hey, I'm going to go for a bike ride on Friday and I get the same reward. I've unwound, I've relaxed, and that creates a new habit. So you replace a bad habit with a good habit by having the same stimulus, the same reward, but substituting the behaviour. But there's a catch. Charles Duhigg says, we never ever totally get rid of a bad habit. So come time of a crisis, say you have a really bad day at work, we will all revert to the original bad habit. You have a really bad day at work, Friday, drinks, you're going to have a beer because you had a really bad day. There's only one way we can stop us reverting to the original bad habit. Well, two ways. We need two things, according to Charles Duhigg. We need the power of a community. We need a network of friends to call upon who say, hey, don't do that. And we need the belief in a transcendent purpose. I am better than this. My life means more than this. We need the belief in a transcendent purpose. All right, so that's tip number two. the power to unleash a good habit and how to replace bad habits, and also the role that community and the belief in a transcendent purpose plays in forming habits. Number three, we need a direction. We need a purpose, we need a direction. If I was to give you a lift in the car, I say, hey, jump in my car, and all I do is just drive round and round and round the block, you would go nuts after a while. Because you would say, where are we going? And I'm just saying, nowhere, I'm just making it up. That would just drive you up the wall. Because you don't just jump in a car to go round and round and round the block. The point of a car is we're meant to be going somewhere. There needs to be a direction. And life is the same. Life needs a direction. Life needs a purpose. Paul Dolan, in his book Happiness by Design, says we need two things to be happy. You see that in the subtitle, finding pleasure and purpose in everyday life. We need two things to be happy, pleasure and purpose, a direction. And the funny thing is, just pleasure by itself will not give us happiness. Because there are many things that do give us pleasure, say just watching TV or beer and pizza gives us pleasure, but by itself, those things soon just become empty and meaningless. What we need is purpose. And purpose is actually more important than pleasure. Because we can think of certain things in life which have no pleasure, but are very purposeful, and they lead to happiness. Like childbirth is very unpleasant, but it's very purposeful, and it leads to happiness. Helping a friend move house, very unpleasant, but it's purposeful and it leads to happiness. Or studying for exams, very unpleasant, but it's purposeful and might lead to happiness. So purpose, in my purpose is much more important than pleasure when it comes to happiness. But it just means we need purpose, we need a direction in life. Steve Bidoff, in his book on manhood, says the secret to job satisfaction is this. What leads to job satisfaction is not the pay, it's not how much they're paying us, it's whether the job feels purposeful or not. See, no matter what they pay us, it will never feel enough. It's not about the pay, it's whether the job feels purposeful or not. And Steve Bidoff says the irony is the two most satisfying jobs are the two that don't pay that well, and that's teaching and nursing, because they feel immediately, concretely purposeful. See, in work, we need purpose, we need a direction, we need meaning. It's the same relationships. Relationships start off with just pleasure. You know, hey, we're gonna watch movies, we'll have dinner, there'll be the romance. But after a while, the couple will sit down and say, where are we going with this? And that's why relationships break down. If they're not going anywhere, the pleasure, the going out, the movies, the dinners, the romance can't sustain it. Relationships need a direction. They need a purpose. And life needs a direction. Life needs a purpose. And that's why job satisfaction plateaus at the 10-year mark. After 10 years in a job, job satisfaction plateaus. Because if you had your 5 years of getting competent, if you had your five years of being competent, now you're thinking, where is this job going? Where am I going? And the midlife crisis can kick in anywhere between 30 and 50, and that's a stage when we ask ourselves, well, who am I? Where am I going? And where is this job going? So our work needs a purpose, our relationships need a purpose, and our life needs a purpose. Our life needs a direction. Lesson number four, we need to nurture our spirit. We need to nurture our spirit. Now, this is Toby, my oldest son. He's 7 years old, and he just loves to run. He just loves to run. And he asked me, Dad, how do I make my legs move? And I said, your brain tells your legs to move. And then he said to me, how do I tell my brain to tell my legs to move? And I said, Toby, you have stumbled upon what philosophers call the mind-body duality problem. Maybe you're familiar with that as well. And the problem is this, we are more than body. We are more than atoms. We are more than matter. There's something immaterial. There's a mind. There's a consciousness. There's a free will that we have that cannot be explained by just the atoms, the molecules, and the body that we have. We're more than robots. We're more than computers. We respond to cause and effect and a predetermined code. We have a mind. We have a consciousness. We have a spirit. This is what philosophers call the mind-body duality problem. We are more than just our bodies. We have a spirit. Now, if you were to see me as a patient, and I was your doctor, the trouble with medicine is, as a doctor, I have been trained to see you as a head, two arms, two legs, and some vital organs. And then when you come to hospital, we just call you by, could the broken leg in bed 3 please come to x-ray? And you think, that is so dehumanizing. I'm more than just a broken leg. But in medicine, we just treat you as a body. And we respond by saying, that is so dehumanizing. I'm more than a body. I'm a human. I'm a person. Yes, I have a mind. I have a consciousness. I have a free agency. I have free will. I have a spirit. I am, and we would argue, our lives are somehow sacred. There's a sanctity to our lives. So think about it. In this room, we would all view ourselves as equal. And we'll all view our lives as of value and worth something. Well, where does the value come from? Where does the worth come from? And why are we equal? See, what we're arguing is our worth, our value, and our equality doesn't come from our achievements, doesn't come from our HSC mark, doesn't come from our university degrees, doesn't come from the parents that we have. It comes from the fact that we are human beings, we are persons, we have a spirit that is sacred, that needs to be valued. There is a sanctity to our lives. And in the same way we have to look after our bodies for bodily health, same way we have to look after our minds for mental health, we have to look after our spirit for spiritual health. Steve Bidoff, in his book on manhood, has many chapters. He's got chapters on work, he's got chapters on sex and marriage, he's got chapters on parenting, and his last chapter is called The Spirit. Because according to Steve Bidoff, in the same way we need to work at our work and relationships, we also have to work on our spirit. And Steve Bidoff argues that the spirit isn't just this thing that we tap onto our work and relationships. He says we are spirit. Our spirit animates the way we work, animates the way we relate, animates the way we use our money. And Steve Bidoff says to be fully person, to be fully human, nurture the spirit, look after the spirit, and he would suggest through prayer, meditation, and connecting with the sacred. In other words, in the same ways that we look after our bodies, our minds, we also need to look after our spirit. When I was working as a young doctor, one of my fellow young doctors and flatmate was a guy called David, and so we used to room together, and these were good times. We were young, we were free, we had a lot of money. But these were also hard times because we were lonely, we were lost, and we didn't know what the future would bring. And so we'd spend many nights on the balcony just watching the sunset, have a few drinks, and then we'd talk about the deeper things of life, and soon we'd talk about spirituality. And then David one night asked me, Sam, you seem to know Jesus. What does it mean to know Jesus? And I said, well, Dave, you know how right now we're feeling a bit lost, a bit lonely, and we're looking for someone that we can settle down with in a place called home. In the same way, our spirits can be lost. Our spirits can be lonely. Just trying to settle down in a place called home. Well, when you know Jesus, your spirit has met God. Your spirit has met the Son of God. Your spirit is lonely no more. Your spirit is searching no more. And your spirit gets to settle down in a place called home. Our spirits need a home in the same way we need a home, and our spirits find a home in God. And so the same way we look after our bodies, our minds, we need to also nurture our spirit. Which brings me to the last lesson I would suggest, and that is just try out Jesus. Just try following Jesus. Follow Jesus. Who was Jesus? He's a man who lived 2,000 years ago, but as Christians we believe he was more than just a good man. He was the Son of God, and somehow by knowing Jesus, we get to know God himself. And Jesus himself made this amazing claim, and I'll just read it out for you. He said this, "If any of you wants to be my follower, turn from your selfish ways and follow me. If you try to hang on to your life, you will lose it. But if you give up your life for my sake, you will save it. What do you benefit if you gain the whole world but are yourself lost or destroyed?" Jesus is saying, hey, follow me. And that would be my fifth suggestion, fifth lesson in life. Follow Jesus. Well, why follow Jesus? Well, we all have to live for something or someone, otherwise we're not living for anything. We all need a direction in life, otherwise our life is going nowhere. We all need an adventure in life, otherwise all we're doing is eating, sleeping, and paying the bills. Jesus saying, well, follow me. Make me your direction. I will be your journey, and I will be your adventure. But why do we need to follow Jesus? Well, let me show you Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We probably all learned this at university, and there's a hierarchy of needs. So you will remember it begins at the bottom level with food, warmth, and shelter. This is what we need to survive in life. And it's a hierarchy of needs. If we have what we need to survive, the next thing we need is love and belonging. We need a tribe, a community that we belong to. The next thing we need is esteem. We need to feel like we are somebody, we have achieved, that we are respected. And if we achieve all those needs, we get the nirvana, the cherry on the top, self-actualization, or what I would call fulfillment. Finally, our life is fulfilled, rich, and flourishing. Now, think about it. Where does work fit into the hierarchy of needs? Work pays the bills, doesn't it? So work fulfills the bottom level, gives us food, warmth, and shelter, and lets us survive. Work might also give us love and belonging, gives us a network of friends. But can work give us esteem and self-actualization? If I look for those things in my work will burn me out, and I will burn myself out trying to get those things in work. What about friends and family? Where do friends and family belong on that hierarchy of needs? Well, friends and family give us the bottom level. They help us survive, food, warmth, shelter. Friends and family certainly give us love and belonging. But should I use friends and family to give me esteem? Like, should I use my three boys and my wife to make me feel somebody, to use them as a trophy family, a trophy wife, trophy children? No, because that would be using them and then burning them out and also myself getting burnt. So I think only Jesus can give us the esteem and the self-actualization that we need and that we long for. Because Jesus loves us just the way we are. So we are somebody, and that's the esteem. And he gives us direction in life, so that gives us the fulfillment, the self-actualization. They've done studies on how much money we need to be happy. How much money a year do we need to be happy? How much money does our job have to pay us a year to be happy? The answer is $70,000 to $90,000 a year. Why? Because I think if we have that, then we get food, warmth, and shelter. We definitely get the survival. So they say until we get 70 or 90 a year, we're always feeling like we need to earn more. But they said anything more than that actually won't make us any happier. So I think that's a role of money. All it does is fulfill that bottom level of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I have a friend called Spiro, and Spiro worked as a trader in his 20s, and he made more money than he knew what to do with in his 20s, so he went travelling around the world in his 30s. And while he was travelling around the world in his 30s, he travelled with some friends who believed in Jesus and followed Jesus. And gradually, bit by bit, Spiro also came to know Jesus, trust Jesus, and follow Jesus. And I talked to Spiro. He says, you know, now that I'm a follower of Jesus, I hear that there are people out there who call themselves Christians who say they have known Jesus all their life. Somehow they were born with parents who told them about Jesus very early on. Maybe they heard about Jesus from school, from some friends. But they say they have known Jesus all their life. And Spiro said to me, do you know what I think when I hear them say that? He said, I envy them. I would give up all the money I made in my 20s if that meant I could have known Jesus earlier. Because it's Jesus that fulfills me, not all the money and the status that I made. So if you'd ask Spiro what his lesson in life, what he wishes he knew back then that he knows now, it will be this: to know Jesus, to trust Jesus, and to follow Jesus. So we've just heard our five tips and how they work in life. So I'll just share with you my story, and that might also explain why they were my five lessons that I decided to share with you. So as you can see, I'm Asian, and I'm also a high achiever. And so I was that annoying Asian kid. I was that Asian kid in primary school who stuck up his hand always and said, Miss, I've finished all my work. Can you give me some more work, please? I was that kid in high school where when I got 99% in a chemistry exam, I was worried about the 1% that I didn't get. And I ended up at City Uni doing medicine. So that's the top 1% of the state. So I was an Asian, typical Asian high achiever. But here's the thing with being a high achiever: success, status, and achievements are never enough. So I was always looking for another mountain to climb. I was always looking for another trophy to earn, because I needed trophies to prove, not to other people, but to myself, that I was somebody. And as a high achiever, you remember your mistakes more than your achievements. So I was always pushing myself to the next success, the next project, the next award, the next achievement. And so as a high achiever, the irony is you're juggling two emotions: pride and also this deep-seated insecurity and fear. But then in my 20s, I got to really, really, really know Jesus in a way I didn't before. And when I came to know, trust, and follow Jesus, I knew that Jesus loved me just for who I was. And I could just be somebody without having to achieve anything. I was somebody in Jesus' eyes. And then Jesus gave me a direction, a purpose in life. So I didn't have to be chasing mountains anymore. I could just simply follow Jesus. Now, Jesus doesn't promise us a good, happy, wealthy, healthy life, but he promises us a direction and a status, because we are somebody in his eyes. And that meant now I could enjoy work just for what it was. It pays the bills and it produces something useful that benefits society. But I didn't need work for esteem, importance, or success. Work was just work. I had all the success I needed in Jesus' eyes. It also meant I could enjoy my friends and family just for who they were: love and belonging. I didn't need them for status, for success, or for achievement. I had Jesus for that. It also meant I could enjoy my rugby just for what it was: just these guys hitting each other and trying to run up a ball, you know, and then get tackled. I didn't need it to feel important. I didn't need it for my identity. I didn't need it for my success. My friends also look back now and they can't believe the change they see in me. My old flatmate says, you drive so normally now. Apparently I used to drive like an idiot because I was just rushing everywhere. Even I sort of don't recognize myself. At parties, I don't try to dominate the conversation like I used to, because I used to be so insecure. I was a jerk. But now I'm just very comfortable with who I am because of Jesus. So what I wish I knew back then that I know now is, if I know Jesus, trust Jesus, and follow Jesus, I will be somebody in Jesus' eyes. I can be comfortable with who I am, and he gives me the direction and purpose that drives life, work, and my relationships.
Question number one: how can I trust that Jesus is the right direction and that I won't follow him and get to the end of my life and realize I should have been following something else?
All right, so the question was, how do I know I can trust Jesus, follow him?
Well, how do I know if Jesus is the right direction?
And I'm not going to come to the end of my life to find out if it's the wrong direction. Yeah. I should have gone in another direction.
Yeah,
yeah, that's very, very, very good. Okay, so the maybe way to think about it is, you know, in my fourth point, I said we should nurture the spirit. Steve Bidoff, just in very general terms, I don't think his book Manhood is a Christian book. I'm not sure if Steve Bidoff is a Christian. He's just very sympathetic to spirituality. So he suggests praying, meditating, connecting with the sacred. And that stage we think, well, which sacred? You know, which, who do I pray to? How do I meditate? And, you know, when we think about all the major forms of spirituality and religion, they have a lot in common. You know, they have traditions, they have rituals, they encourage praying, they encourage connecting with the sacred, and they encourage us to do good, like love your neighbour, do unto others as you love yourself. C.S. Lewis in his book, Mere Christianity, at the back just shows how there's just so much commonality between Christianity and other forms of belief and religions and spirituality. So it leaves us basically really with several choices. Are all religions the same? So really I can just pick anyone I want. In that case, it really doesn't matter whether we follow Jesus or not, because they're all the same. Or is there only one way to connect to the sacred? And then I better find out which way that is, and might be Jesus, it might not be Jesus. And I love the parable, and it's a famous Asian parable, where it talks about how, you know, there's an elephant in the room, and all these people are blind, and some people touch the elephant. One blind man touches the tail and says, oh, I know what this is a rope. Another man touches the leg of the elephant and says, I know what this is a tree trunk. Another one touches the trunk of the elephant and says, I know what this is a garden hose. But we all know it's an elephant, so they just have different ways of describing the same thing. And so maybe that's what all major religions are. They're just different ways to describe the sacred, culturally determined. So if I be born in China, I'll be a Buddhist. If I was born in India, I'd be a Hindu. But hey, I'm in Australia, so Christianity is a Western religion, supposedly. So that's why I'm a Christian. But really, they're just our different ways, our culturally determined ways of describing and praying to the same God. All right, so that's one way of looking at it. The other way of saying, well, there's a problem with that parable is if all the people in the room are blind, how come we're not blind as well? Well, how come I can see it's an elephant and they can't see it's an elephant? That's claiming quite what philosophers call an epistemic privilege point. Like, how come I have a point of privilege that every major world religion doesn't have? Or, with the other problem of parables, assumes the elephant can't talk. And what Christianity claims is the elephant does talk. It says, hey, I'm an elephant. And so one of the big things that Christians believe in the Bible claims is God isn't just God, he's not just a loving God, he's just not a personal God, he's a speaking God. He reveals himself to us in many ways, Bible being one, but the climactic way is Jesus came, the Son of God, 2,000 years ago, said many things, recorded down by many different people, and he claimed, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. Come to you know me, you will know the sacred. You will know the one who sent me. You will know God. So it comes down to whether we believe God speaks or whether we let the fumble around in the dark. And if so, how can we know more than other world religions? And it all comes down to whether we believe when Jesus speaks, he is speaking the truth. Yeah. And one big claim that Christians find very reassuring is Jesus claims, and the claim is, he rose from the dead. And if he rose from the dead, that means there is life after death. There is a supernatural. There is a God behind this. And Jesus appeared not just to his followers, but to 500 eyewitnesses that get all recorded. And it all comes down to, like, are we willing to trust and believe this? And at some stage, they say there's propositional knowledge. I know this to be true. But there's acquaintance knowledge, and there's know-how knowledge. So I can know George Street to be a main street in Sydney. That's propositional knowledge. But I can be acquainted with George Street, so I know where the coffee shops in George Street are, or I can have a skilled know-how of George Street where I can get around George Street. I know where all the shortcuts are. So how can I know if Jesus is really who he claims to be? I can debate it at a propositional level, or I can come down one more level and say, well, how about I try him out? Have an acquaintance knowledge of Jesus. Or how about I enter a relationship with Jesus where I go, I'm just going to trust you this, I'm going to follow, and then there'll be what's called a skill, know-how knowledge. There's a difference between reading Chopin, knowing Chopin's music when you recognise it, and being able to play Chopin. And see, the philosophers say that we can always debate claims of truth at the abstract level, but we'll never know for sure until we try it out. How do we know the hamburger is really $5 in the shop as it claims to be? Am I dreaming this? Am I a butterfly in China having this dream? Well, you will never know. You will never know in the abstract. The only way to find out is pull out the $5, pay for it, and get the hamburger. And so I say, read the claims of Jesus and their multitude of claims, and at a trust level, take it one level and say, I'm just going to trust Jesus on this. And it's the same when a girl asks you out. So I have two friends, they've been married for a long time now, so their marriage is very happy. But when the guy asked her out, she needed a police record check on him. Because how would you know? How would you know he's not an axe murderer? And that's the point, you don't. To some stage, you've got to say, okay, I'm going to take a trusting on this. I'm just going to trust him at his word. He's not an axe murderer. Because the police record can't clear everything. And she's been more of that. They've been in a happy married relationship for a long time.
Yeah, that's actually other than the funny story.
I have a friend who's a blacksmith and single. It's because, you know, his hobbies, he makes axes, and I'm sure that doesn't go very well.
Yeah. But that's really helpful, the three levels of knowing, sort of propositional acquaintance and actually hands-on intimate setting. Fantastic. Another question is, Sam, you've made a massive point about following Jesus gives us the direction we need. How does knowing a person give us that? Because I guess if I read a textbook, for example, I would know the answers to questions. But why is knowing a person actually going to give me direction?
Yes. So how does knowing Jesus give me direction? Aren't I just knowing a person? Well, yes, we are just knowing a person, and a big part of a relationship is being rather than doing. And so I am in a relationship. It's not what I do that gets me in a relationship. I am in a relationship, and that affects what I do. So it's the other way around. Yes, so that bit's true. But the relationship with Jesus is special because he loves us so much. He loves us the way we are. Okay, he loves us just the way we are, so there's nothing we have to do to earn his love. There's nothing we have to gain or to achieve to get his attention. He loves us just the way we are, but he loves us too much to keep us the way we are. So the Bible says he has a plan, he has a project for us. And part of that project is he's going to make us more and more like him. The Bible says we don't just know Jesus. He comes and puts his spirit in us. Remember, there's a spirit side of us, and there's a spirit side of Jesus. He puts his spirit in us and slowly changes us from the inside out, making us more and more like Jesus and knowing him more and more fully. So that gives us a direction, a project in life.
Last question.
Sure.
How can you know, trust, and follow someone you've never met? You really don't even know. How can you know Jesus just from reading a book?
How can I know Jesus just from reading a book? Yes, so the Bible uses many metaphors and illustrations to explain what our relationship with Jesus is like. Jesus sometimes says, hey, it's like we're friends. You're my friend, I'm your friend. So it's like a friendship. Sometimes he says, hey, it's like I'm a shepherd, you're my sheep, I guide you, I protect you, I look after you. Sometimes Jesus says, it's even like we're married, you're the bride, I'm the groom. And so it's a very intimate relationship. But the analogy at some stage has to break down, because I'm married to my wife, and tonight I'm going to see her. I'm going to hold her hand, I'm going to say hi to her, she'll give me a kiss on the cheek. It's actually her birthday, I just remembered. So I'm going to say happy birthday when I get home tonight as well. All right, but we can't really do that with Jesus. We can't hold his hand, we can't touch him. And so on the one sense, the analogy breaks down, but it's more like a long-distance relationship thing. So I remember there was a time when I was staying in America where I was away from my wife for 2 or 3 months. So we communicated. In fact, then there was no Skype, there was nothing like that. So we couldn't see each other, but we could write to each other and email each other. So we had each other's words. And they say the key part of communication, the key part of intentionality, and the key part of the way agents and agents relate with each other is through a word. So if you make billboards react, you just throw them at each other. So that's cause and effect, okay? But how do persons relate? They relate through a word. So tonight I get home and I say, hi, I love you, happy birthday. It's a word, and we relate and connect through a word. So Jesus connects with us through a word. But it's more than that, because the Bible claims there was a time when you could see Jesus touch him. So one of the followers of Jesus was called John, and John says, you know, it's amazing. We did see him, we did touch him, we did hear his words, and that's why we're writing it all down for you now to preserve what we saw, what we touched, and what we heard. So we're just one stage removed. We have the words, not the physical proximity, but relationships can survive on words, and that's the key part of relationships. Because think about it, you can have the opposite. We have the physical proximity without the words. So you know, imagine a relationship where your wife doesn't want to talk to you. So that's not much of a relationship, even though you are holding hands and seeing each other. It's the words that make it's a key component of relationship. And I always love how men and women relate. So the woman would say, oh, we're not talking anymore. Well, we're talking now, aren't we? And the point is, words are very important when it comes to relationship.
Yeah. Thanks, Dan.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.